Thanks again to everyone that's read Helped Us Open the Meeting. I'll take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. A warm welcome to any visitors and a massive welcome to anyone new or coming back tonight, find themselves in an NA meeting. I hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So yeah, we do have a speaker tonight and it falls on me to introduce them. And I don't know much about this gentleman other than where he lives and he's got a bit of time in the programme. I'm looking forward to hearing what he's got to say. So he's going to ask him to share his experience, strength and hope with us for 40, 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable with. The journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous. So Gary, the floor is yours, my friend. Please jump in and share with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. My name's Gary. Thanks. I'm an addict.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, Gary. Welcome.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for the warm welcome, especially before the meeting started and getting to know you a little bit, the people who were on there before the meeting. Thanks to everybody who's helped set up the meeting and put this meeting on. It's brilliant what you're doing. I know my friend is isolated in a foreign country, and he struggles to get to meetings, and he's finding this meeting a life saviour. So everybody who's been involved in putting it on, it's brilliant what you do, and I'm just so grateful to this fellowship for what it's given me. I have everything that I have in my life. I put down to Narcotics Anonymous. I'll just give you a little bit about, when I grew up in a working class town in the north of England, and I always felt different. I'm not saying this is why I'm an addict. This is just how I felt growing up. I always felt a little bit different. I was adopted. I was adopted as a baby. So I moved from, I was in an orphanage for a very brief time, and then I was adopted out to a family in Lancashire. And from there, I knew from a young age that I'd been adopted. My mum and dad, who brought me up, and I call mum and dad, they let me know that that I had been adopted, that was special, that was chosen. But I always felt a little bit different. And as children can be sometimes cruel, you'd get children saying it's not your proper mum and dad and things like that. And they did the best. They were brilliant. They really tried hard to make everything as right as they can. I think I was probably more my mother's wish than my father's wish, although he was a decent man, and he did what he could as well. But he was away a lot when I was younger, in my teens, and that's the time that I started getting really into mischief and into trouble and drinking, and then more drugs come along as I get a little bit older. And I always wanted to be somebody else. I'd never felt comfortable in my own skin. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know why it was. I thought if I was as good looking as this guy, or if I was as funny as this guy, or as good at sport as this person, or as popular as such a person, or as intelligent as this person, I thought everything would be all right if I looked this particular way. And I always had this feeling of unease within myself. I didn't know why. I can't say what it was down to. I had really low self-esteem and low self-worth. Really didn't value who I was. Couldn't show affection to my family. I never felt that. I always grew up in a town where showing emotions was a sign of weakness in the time that I was growing up, in the 70s and 80s. And it wasn't something that was encouraged, or many people did. And if you did show any emotion or weakness, you were preyed upon. And I learned that I didn't want to do that. So I'd be one of the people taunting people who did. I didn't know any different. And I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be accepted. I was always seeking approval of people. So my mum, she used to work for... Back in the 70s and 80s, There are no substance misuse services as such. If people had a drug problem, or they had, especially if they had serious drug problems, they went to the local psychiatrist in my town, and the local psychiatrist was, well, he wasn't a very pleasant individual anyway. He used to get off on abusing young men. And I'd heard these tales, you know, my mum had heard them, but she didn't believe them. She thought he was a good guy. She told me all the tales about people coming and smashing his door down and demanding drugs and the police being called up and various people dying, etc., from overdoses and things like that. And this was when I was about 14, 15. And I thought, I'll never end up there. I'll never see that man, ever. And, you know, probably before my 20th birthday or around that time, I was actually there getting prescriptions off him for, you know, substitute drugs for opiates. And I didn't know how that had happened. And it was, I couldn't believe how I'd actually got to that position. I'd heard all the stories about this guy, you know. Later on, in my active addiction, he ended up being prosecuted and sent to prison, etc., for some of the crimes that he did. He'd been reported to the police many times by many drug addicts, but the police just used to dismiss it and say, they're all the junkies, nobody believes a word they're saying. But he was caught, you know, with a young lad who had poor mental health, and yeah, anyway, he was caught by a member of staff, and then it all came out about him and stuff like that. But that was, but even knowing all that and the drugs that I used, I never thought that I had a problem with lots of different drugs. I thought that I only had a problem with one or two particular drugs when I came to the rooms of NA. People couldn't, I couldn't understand when people talked about the disease of addiction, and it doesn't matter what or how much you use. But when I look back at my drug use and all the drugs that I used, and I used lots of different drugs, I could see that whatever drug I used, it became problematic and my life became unmanageable. And I became obsessed and compulsed, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop using it. From smoking weed, I'd be going to bed at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be getting up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, didn't work, completely idle. I would, if I was taking amphetamines, I used to hate the feeling of amphetamines. I really didn't like it, but I just liked this little rush that I got for, you know, 30 seconds or so after putting a needle in and giving me that little hit. But the feeling after it, I didn't like. It really made me uncomfortable. But do you know, within the matter of half an hour, I'd be doing it again, just chasing that rush and that rush. That brings all the psychosis. It still didn't stop. Used to move from different parts of the country. I lived in East Lancashire, but I would move away to Cornwall. I'd swap the opiates for the amphetamines. So I was doing the geographicals, doing the swapping the drugs. And it was mainly opiates that was my problem, but it didn't matter what I used. And I remember one time I was in my early 20s, in mid-20s, I was up before the probation officer for a pre-sentence report, and he said, you used to have a problem with alcohol, didn't you, when you was, you know, in your late teens and stuff. And I flared up and I've jumped up. I said, what are you talking about? You don't know what you're on about. And he said, well, in 6 months, you had 3 drunken disorderlies and 2 public order offences. No, the evidence was as plain as it could be. But I still couldn't see it. I was still in complete denial that I had a problem with alcohol, because the people that I associated with, because I was seeking that approval, as I talked about, I didn't feel comfortable in my skin, complete misfit. The people that I graduated towards, the people that I received acceptance from, were just as messed up as I were, you know, and it was the football hooligans, and it was the criminals, and it was the problematic drug takers. They were the people that I fitted in with, the misfit amongst the misfits, and that is, and so all the behaviours that I were doing, all my associates were doing similar behaviours as well. So I couldn't see that it was problematic. I just thought it was how it was. And I used all these different drugs, you know, but like I say, the ones that caused me the problem were mainly the opiate-based drugs. And it was like 1988, and I was sent to prison for the first time. I was 21, 22. And I was sent in Drexel prison in southwest England, and it was all, and my cellmate at the time, he must have seen that I had a problem. He was a little bit older than me, a little bit more experienced in that world, shall we say, and he said, why don't you come to this meeting? And it was a meeting of the other fellowship. It was a meeting of our mother fellowship, and I've gone along to that meeting, and you know, I went there every week for, I don't know, a month or so. And I went because I could get out of the cell, and the guys who came in brought cigarettes and, you know, and things like that, and I could have a brew. And I couldn't see that I had a problem. Now, at this particular time, I'd moved away from Northwest England. I'd got off what I thought was my problem drug, the opiates, etc., and I'd moved to Cornwall, and I was taking the amphetamines, and I was taking the ecstasy and stuff like that, and smoking loads of weed. And I was out every night drinking alcohol. And that was every single night. It was that I was committing crime to live this party lifestyle. And yet I was sat in prison, and I was at a meeting of our mother fellowship, and I could not see that I had a problem with that particular drug, because My drugs were all different kinds of drugs. That was just something that I used along with all the other stuff. It I couldn't identify that it was causing me problems, but it was just one of many drugs that caused me problems. But I couldn't see it. They looked different. They were older. And the stories were different, etc. And that was it. And then I had no other encounters with any 12-step fellowships until, you know, my first NA meeting, 12, 13 years later. And during that time, after getting out of that prison on the first time, I went back to prison many, many times. You know, I spent the majority of time in the institutions from that first sentence until I found recovery, until NA found me. And it was... We know, you know, I'm not talking about anything that's probably unique to me. The disease got more progressive. The consequences became more severe. I harmed a lot more people, including myself. I stole thousands from my family. I stole thousands and tens of thousands from people I didn't know. I never worked. I thought it was my obligation that I should take anything that I want, and I didn't need to earn anything. I didn't need to work like other people. And through that, through committing crime all the time, I did quite a bit of time in institutions. I never thought of selling drugs as even committing crime. I thought that was just something I did. This is how deluded and how much denial I was in. And it wasn't until, going back to September, well, July 99, my father was really ill. I'd just lost another relationship. It was a chaotic relationship, a using relationship. The drugs business had crumbled. I say drugs business, it was mainly selling street drugs and little things like that, you know. But it funded my habit, it funded my partner's habit. That went to pieces, and I ended up back, you know, skint and desperate, and I'd lost the courage to commit the crimes that I used to, but I ended up committing a crime. Well, I didn't commit the crime. This is, you know, the irony of it. It was actually a miscarriage of justice. I'll joke about that in a funny way. It was, for all the offences that I did, I deserved to be locked up, but this one I didn't. I was accused by a police officer of committing an offence that I didn't commit. It was that, it was her word against mine. I ran a court trial, a Crown Court trial, and surprisingly, I was found guilty by the jury. But it's the best thing that ever happened in my life. And I have so much gratitude for that. If I would have pleaded guilty to that offence, which I had no chance of getting off from because it was my word against the police officers, even though I was innocent, I would have received 2 years imprisonment. But I ran the trial, was found guilty, and I received 3 years instead of two. Now, just before I was arrested for that offence, my father was diagnosed with cancer and he was terminally ill. I used to go up and see him at the hospital when he was full of drugs, and I'd communicate with him verbally. I would speak to him, but there was nothing that came out. There was no emotional connection with him at all. I couldn't feel anything because I was that blocked off with all the drugs that I was taking. And whilst I was on remand for that crime, for that sentence, my father passed away, and my mother said, "I don't want you to come to the funeral." If I would have gone to the funeral, I would have been handcuffed to two prison officers. And the only reason that I would have gone would have been to try and get some drugs off somebody from out in the community. I wouldn't have cared that two prison officers had handcuffs side by side of me. It wouldn't have bothered me. That is how much I was enslaved by addiction at that particular time. But whilst on that sentence, I was coming towards 12 months, which I'd done in the local prison that I was in. And the guy who, there was a friend of mine, he said, "Look," said, "why don't you try this 12-step treatment centre within this prison?" And I'd forgotten all about my previous experience many years ago with the Mother Fellowship. And I asked him a little bit about what it was. And at this time, I'd given up on life. I believed that I was going to be a drug addict. I was going to die a drug addict. You know, I was either going to spend a long time in prison. I was going to overdose. I was going to get done in. Or best case scenario, I might end up on cheap lagers, strong lagers, and prescription drugs and the odd bit of street drugs now and again. And I'd resign myself to that fact. But this guy, he carried a message to me. He gave me a little bit of hope. And I went to this institution where there was a treatment centre within this prison, and he shared, and the first meeting that I went into, I heard my story. I was so blessed that the very first NA meeting that I went into, I heard my story. It was a guy who had used like me, who thought like me, who behaved like me, so many other similar behaviours, similar to around the gambling, the crime, whatever. It was just, it was like looking at a mirror of myself. And this guy was a few months clean. I couldn't believe it. You know, it absolutely blew my mind away. Because I'd not experienced this before. I'd not seen people like that. Now, what happened I had 6 months left to serve in that institution. I was on the treatment program and stuff like that. But every Tuesday are the days that stick out in my mind. Because every Tuesday night, week in, week out, month in, month out, two guys from Narcotics Anonymous would come into that institution and they would share their experience. And each time they came, I went back to my cell, dormitory, whatever it was at the time, with hope, with my soul filled with hope. They lit a fire in me that I started believing that maybe, just maybe, I don't have to be a slave to this addiction. Maybe there's a chance that I can find recovery. And for somebody who had been completely hopeless and helpless, that there was no way out, it was, I'm sure lots of you have experienced it. It was absolutely beautiful and wonderful to know. And when I got back to the cell, I'd read a little bit of the basic text, you know, every time after each of the shares. I'll be honest, I didn't read much of the 10 chapters at first. It was all mainly about the stories in the back in the fifth edition and about the stories, the personal stories and the identification that I got from those stories. And there was good people around me. And so, you know, the beauty of this is that institution is... you know, it closed in about 2006, 2007, and the rehab and everything that went with it. And there was no more in there because there was no more prison. It went. But there were quite a few of us around this area who have stayed clean through Narcotics Anonymous. Maybe some have relapsed and come back, whatever. But, you know, still quite a few of us who were in recovery, who went through that institution. And next Saturday, there's going to be an H&R Unity Day within that prison. And, you know, I'm very humbled that, you know, the service committee have asked me to speak at that. And I'm getting emotional thinking about it now, because it's the spiritual home, finding recovery within that prison. It's a place of hopelessness and despair. But that place was, that lit a spark in me, because Narcotics Anonymous came in there for no other reason. That is the reason. Those guys came in and carried a message to me and showed me that there was a way out and a way to recover from this disease. What a beautiful, beautiful thought when I think about it like that. And these guys, you know, some of them are still going to NA now. Some of them are still involved in service and doing whatever they're doing. Some of, one guy became a sponsor for a few years. I've got some really good friends from those guys who used to come in and talk about it. And I'm thankful when I speak to them. We have a laugh sometimes about stuff, but I'm thankful. Some of them say, don't forget I saved your life. They don't forget it's NA, not you. You're just a messenger, just like I am. But we have a good laugh about it. And I came out of there and I did what suggested, really. I got involved with the fellowship. I didn't know at the time that I really believed that I would stay clean. I had it beat. I sort of had this understanding, I believe I did at the time, that I knew that I was powerless over my addiction. What I knew was that I was powerless over drug addiction, or believed that I was. I didn't understand about the disease of addiction. And I started acting out in other ways, and I was nearly a year clean, and I got into a relationship that I shouldn't, and I started lying and then gambling, and then before long I'm committing a crime, and I've ended up using loads of different drugs within this, from smoking weed, dropping E's, alcohol, and all to cracking heroin within the space of a few hours. And it was down to the guys that, you know, that were about at the time, that then I got hooked up with my sponsor and I started taking the work seriously. And I had a relapse a couple of months later on alcohol. And then since July 2001, I've thanks to God and thanks to the fellowship and thanks to the literature of the program and the people in the program, I've been able to stay clean. And you know, that's not down to me. That's down to my increasing, developing relationship with a higher power, and the things that I try and do for the fellowship when I can. You know, try and give a little bit back that was given to me. It was, I don't know, I'm trying to think now, yeah. So when around that time, the people, you know, there were a lot of people, there was a treatment centre around here, then meetings started spreading up all over. And I was just speaking with a friend of mine at the moment a few days ago, and talking about how many people actually stick about. And it's not so many, do you know, who stick about the fellowships, who get clean through the fellowships. And I'm one of the fortunate ones that have been able to do that. You know, I've been through the work, I go through the program, I take people through the program. It's, I didn't know that I had, when I came here, I didn't know that I had a disease. I didn't know that it was the first one that did the damage. I always thought it was the second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever. I always thought that if I wouldn't have turned down that street, I wouldn't have been arrested. I never thought if I wouldn't have taken the drugs, I would have been arrested. I always had to look at something else as to what had happened to me. I was always the victim. I would always blame other people for my situation. I would always feel like hard done by everybody. I was full of resentment, full of anger. And coming to the fellowship, I was taught about all this stuff. I was taught about what I had. I was taught that you know, if I didn't take that first drug, I'll be all right. I was taught about the message. You know, I was taught that an addict, any addict can stop using, lose the desire to use and find a new way to live. And the examples of that was that I saw it in the rooms. I've seen the evidence of it. I've seen many, many people who were in recovery and were helping get better lives and were being of service to the families, being of service to the communities, to their employers, most importantly to the fellowship and to the new guys that, you know, that come about. If there's anybody new in here, this program is, it's just the most wonderful thing that I can think of. I can't put it into words. My own group's a group where we read the basic text every week, and it's a basic text study group. And whilst I was in institutions, I did a lot of reading, read a lot of books, read a lot of fiction, a lot of non-fiction. But of all the books that I've read, none of them come a million miles within what the basic text means to me. It's so life-saving. When we talk about life-saving literature, that book is life-saving literature. And I can't, you know, I'm blessed that I'm part of a home group that goes through that. I mean, I've been a home group member for quite a while, because if I wasn't, I wouldn't read it as much. And every time we read a little bit of the text each week, there's usually something that pops out and think, yeah, you know, that resonates with me. That resonates with who I am and what I need to do to combat this disease. He talks about, I didn't know about the development of a higher power. I was brought up a Catholic, so I had, and it wasn't a great experience being brought up in that religion. And as I got older, I completely shunned away from it and didn't have anything to do with it. I'm not a religious person now. If you are, that's great. It doesn't matter. But what I have done, consistently now for quite a long time, is that I get up in the morning, I say a few little prayers to whoever, you know, whoever my God and my understanding is. I don't fully understand it. And I am my will and my life over. I pray for a few people. I pray for my family, sponsees, sponsor, other people who might be struggling, etc. People that have passed. And do a little meditation. And usually, the day goes reasonably well. And what that does is, when I'm doing that, I'll take the wheel back many times during the day, but even just doing that in a disciplined manner daily, I usually find that I respond to situations much better than I used to most of the time. I really can respond and react positively most of the time. It gives me the ability to take personal responsibility, to deal with life on life's terms, as it says in our literature. That's what I do. It, through the help of being in contact with you guys in the fellowship, being in contact with my sponsor, doing a little bit of work, doing that little bit of prayer and meditation, handing my will and my life over, it then gives me the ability to, as we go through the program, it's important for me that I had I've had two or three of these big clear outs where we call step four and five, where we look at all the resentments that have caught up with me and all the fears that I'm hanging on to, or other behaviours where I've harmed people. And some cases I might have been wronged in some of those cases, but that, the most important thing in this is that I get to the exact nature of my wrongs, that I find out what are my defects. I can guarantee they're the same ones all the time. I'm selfish, I'm dishonest, full of fear, I'm very self-centered. You know, that's the person that I am without any drugs in me. So that's why I need this program to combat that. And I try to apply those principles daily. Somebody said something which resonated really. If you have a drunken horse thief and you take away the drink, what are you left with? You're left with a horse thief. And that's why I was like, I came into recovery, I put the drugs down, but I was still selfish, dishonest, still a thief. I still was all these people. I was manipulative. I would cheat. I was deceitful. But that's what I am without any drugs. To combat that, this program gives me a way of life that helps me change from the person that I am without a program into the person that I want to be with a program. And by applying these principles, I've been able to live a better life. You know, I haven't been arrested since I've been in recovery. I haven't harmed family. I've built up relationships with family, and I never had a. There were some cousins who I'd never even met until they were in the 20s, because for whatever reason, whether that was because I didn't want to see them, they interfered with my using, or maybe their parents, you know, my mum's brothers and stuff, didn't want them to meet me because I was such, you know, I was such a mess. I don't know, but it was probably a combination of the two. But since coming into recovery, I've built some brilliant relationships with my extended family, with my cousins, and I've been to quite a few of the weddings, been on holiday with them, and that, again, it's all come about through this. And there was a time, you know, early in my recovery when part of what we have to do is make amends, and I couldn't make amends to my dad, so I had to do the graveside amends, because he passed whilst I was still in active addiction. I was still in there. And that was very, very, very powerful. But, you know, I was about 4 or 5 years clean, and my mum developed terminal illness as well. She developed a very aggressive form of cancer. And the difference is that I was able to be there for her. I was able to go to the hospital and go to the hospice. I had a very, regularly, I didn't drive at the time, and it was 40, 50 miles from where I lived. I had a very understanding employer who let me let me work a 4-day week instead of a 5-day week. But most importantly, again, in all that, is that I had some amazing, beautiful, wonderful people in the fellowship. And some of them, quite a few of them, are still good friends today. They would drive me over to the hospital. They would drive me to the hospice. They would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that's what I find in NA, is that if you can't, you know, if you're struggling, we'll be there for you. You know, and I try to do that now for other people. It's only things that have been done for me and things that have been shown for me. And when I first came into recovery in this area, there was a guy I was at a meeting, I had nowhere to go, I didn't have a penny, and he put me up in his house that night. He'd never even met me, it was the first ever meeting in the community. He put me up in his house, he bought me some food, he gave me a load of literature, and he gave me some money to get some breakfast in the morning. Now, roll on 20 odd years, and this guy, in that time, last year he'd just finished an 9-year prison sentence. He'd used in and out for most of that 20 years that I've been in recovery, 22 years that I've been in recovery. He's just picked his 9-month keyring up today. He's at a rehab at another part of the county, and he's coming over to see his family on Wednesday. And I'm now in a position where I have my own house and stuff like that, and I have enough. You know, and he'll be staying here on Wednesday night, and he stayed here before in the past. And now that's, I'm able to give a little bit back. You know, that's the gratitude that I had for that man is unreal. But it's just so nice to be able to appreciate that I can give a little bit back to him as well, and make his life a little bit easier as well. That he doesn't have to try and find an hotel around this part of town where sometimes it might be a bit more expensive or not great accommodation, etc. And it's just what we do, isn't it? We help each other. We be of service to each other. And I've always had a home group. I think that's been important for me over the years, is that I've always had a meeting that I attend every week. I have, you know, I try to do little bits of service throughout, you know, throughout fellowship. And as you can possibly gather, the service that's really close to my heart is H&I. It's the part of NA where I got the message. It's the part of NA that I like giving back to more than any. And whenever I go to an institution, you know, whether that be in person or online, I feel spiritualized. My spirit is lifted. I remember I was there. You know, I've been there. I've been in the position that those guys are in. And that's what I've been blessed. I've been able to do thanks to this fellowship allowing me to serve, allowing me to give that bit of time. I've always had a sponsor, and I've always done the work, and I try to sponsor people as well. I have a few sponsees as well, and just trying to give a little bit back to them and it was something that my sponsor said to me, a guy who used to do H&I come into the institution where I was, and he always used to say after we'd done some step work, he'd say, thank you for that. I could never understand when I was early in recovery, why? What have I, you know, I haven't done anything. But as time goes on, I understand the beauty and the gift of being, you know, being privileged to listen to somebody share their experience with me, to share my experience back, and hopefully help along with some suggestions that might help them. And I've had many sponsees who I've identified with, and they've helped me in immense ways as well. It's a two-way thing. I had a situation a few months ago where I was in a lot of emotional pain. Self-created, got obsessed around an individual, etc., and it caused a lot of pain. And I had a sponsee, you know, who over the years, when anything like this had happened, and I've done it to many sponsees, said, why don't you do an inventory? You know, just do yourself a mini step 4 and 5, get to the exact nature of your wrongs and look if you need to make any amends, but get that inventory done now and see if it does any help. And he said, over the years you've suggested this to me many times, why don't you do an inventory? And you know, it was right in front of my face. Now, that is the beauty of this fellowship, is that I cannot see that. I needed another addict to help me see that. And through that, you know, I ended up doing daily inventories for quite a while through the IP, living the program, sending them over, sharing them every night. And you know what? Started feeling better very, very quickly. And I guess, you know, I'll muff on one here, but my connection with my air power has built up and changed over the years, but it's put a lot of work into this. I do some other stuff outside. I do some healing work and stuff like that. And I believe I get signs from spirit guides and things like that. And I have this strong belief that when I die, or when any of us die, that it's not the end. That whatever happens, our soul will go on. Now, it doesn't matter whether anybody else has that belief or not. It's completely, you know, it's your understanding. It's each and everybody's own personal understanding. But I've had the signs and stuff like that that makes me believe that and strongly believe that. And that's a beautiful thing to have again. And that is down to faith and trust in my higher power that has built up over a period of time. Now, I can choose to tune into that, or I can be blocked off from it by going on social media, whatever, anything that can distract me. But when I tune into that kind of stuff, there's nothing beats it. And what I do, the belief, my understanding is that I do the inventory to sortate me. I then do the, no, that's me 10. I do the 11 to actually, to improve that conscious contact, to build that relationship with God. And once I've had a look at me and I've worked with God, I am in a much, much better position to be of service to others and be of help to other people. I'm out of prattled on here, so I think I might have managed to get near the 45 minutes, but feel like I'm drained up a little bit. And I'd just like to thank everybody once again. You know, I hope you've managed to get a little bit out of what I've said. If not, you know the score. Come along to another one and hear somebody else. But thank you very much for allowing me to share. It's a real privilege to be able to do this. And yeah, I love NA. Thank you, guys.